This podcast is for informational purposes only. We are not medical professionals and do not provide medical advice. Consult a healthcare provider for any health concerns. Opinions expressed are not a substitute for professional medical guidance.
Hello and welcome to the Optimize We podcast. I'm your host, Lindsay O'Neill, and today we're going to be sharing biohacking truths and no BS with one of my favorite people, Lisa Wimberger of NeuroSculpting. Now, I met Lisa around 2 years ago. We were both going on stage at Gaia in Colorado, and I have to tell you, she's not only one of my favorite people because of her amazing transformative story and all of the work that she has committed her life to, but she's also just an amazing person. She's a great friend. She's an advocate for people who not only can't advocate for themselves, but just don't know how to. And so today I am so excited to welcome my dear friend Lisa to the podcast.
It's funny because we connected so instantly at that event, and I was marveling at what you're doing. So it's going in both directions.
I love how women are now getting on the bandwagon of supporting each other and having each other's backs. It wasn't always the case, especially when I worked in tech. There was a little bit of catfighting that went on in different companies that I worked in. But when I was on stage, they have a whole plan for all of the speakers, right? And so you barely get a chance to listen to other people talk. So you are the only other talk outside of listening to myself that I actually got to experience firsthand on stage. And your story was mind-blowing. Your story is crazy. Like, it doesn't even sound like a real story. So why don't you tell me a little bit more about who you are and share your story with our audience?
Yeah, every time I say it, it's like, whose life is this? Normal childhood in theory up until, you know, age 15, where I got hit by lightning on my birthday in the base of the spine. It actually came out through me. I was leaning against something metal that was going across the base, like my sacral area, and then the lightning hit the side wall, came out me. I flew through the air. All my friends were in shock. I didn't really know what happened, and I thought someone hit me. I knew there was a storm. I knew there was lightning, but I couldn't put my cognition around it. They all screamed, "You were hit, you were hit, you flew," and I didn't believe them. I was alive, right? So why would I believe them? You're supposed to die when you're hit by lightning.
Were you out cold for a little while, or?
I don't recall if I was. I felt like I was thrown from the garage door. They said I flew. I mean, I landed probably 5 or 6 feet off the door. So it was a big jolt. I don't think I lost consciousness, but I was dazed. And we went back to my friend's house, we were playing at her house. The only thing I actually remember was looking at my wet socks because it had been raining and thinking, oh, wet socks, lightning, bad. Like, literally, that was the only thought I could make. That week, I started having seizures. The way it all unfolds is that fried my nervous system. I exacerbated a very particular stress response in my nervous system, the freeze response, and now I start having seizures for decades.
And these are not normal seizures, though.
No, these are not epileptic seizures, and there's a difference, right? Well, at the time, I wasn't given the epileptic diagnosis because epilepsy is generally showing up as like cortical brain activity, different kind of neural firing patterns. But my seizures were originating in the brainstem. So they were coming from the vagus nerve, which is deconditioned. It was electrocuted. It was fried. And so when there was even the smallest little provocation of stress to my nervous system, whether it was real or perceived or even hormonal changes during my menstrual cycles, my vagus nerve short-circuited. And so a vasovagal seizure starts with a very quick deceleration, it's oxymoron, of your heart. Your heart just plummets. And your heart rate drops so fast that you seize because you stop oxygenating your brain. And in my case, I was flatlining. I wasn't going to low blood pressure. I was going to like completely stopped heart on multiple occasions, not even knowing it.
How long would it stop for? It would just
completely... the best I can tell you, because I didn't even know that was happening until I had a seizure in a doctor's office. Serendipitously, that's where I got my diagnosis. I had been seizing for 15 years before that. Seize in his office, and I wake up to a needle of atropine in his hand. It's like that
this one here heart fiction.
Yes.
Yeah.
He had it right here. He was shaking. I knew I was about to faint. I told him something's wrong, and I'm gone. And then when I open my eyes, he's got a needle of atropine literally about to stick it in my heart. And he tells me, he jumps back and he says, "You flatlined. We couldn't get you breathing. There was no pulse. You flatlined." And so the best to my recollection is the atropine had been in the office next door to his office. So however long it takes him to realize I'm flatlining, tell the nurse to get the atropine, load the needle. That's at minimum how long I was gone.
That's probably a couple of minutes.
Right? Yeah. I honestly don't know. Then they did all the brain work that they usually do. Again, they find nothing. And that's where he says, "This is your vagus nerve and it's shot. And you got to fix this. And we don't have anything to tell you to do to fix it." And that was like the gift and the curse,
right?
The gift of someone finally naming what was happening. The curse of, at that time, Western medicine really wasn't on the polyvagal bandwagon. Like, nobody was talking about that.
Yeah.
And so they basically said, don't squat and stand up too fast and make sure you have salt in your diet. That was the regimen.
To stay hydrated, like... Have salt in your diet to stay hydrated, and then don't stand up too quickly.
I got my official puzzle pieces together diagnosis at 30. I had been seizing for 15 years, either trying to diminish what was happening or trying to convince the person that was there with me not to tell my parents or trying to hide it from my parents. Like, sometimes I would seize more often right when I got home from school, and I would seize in the bathroom. I remember I would get home about 2 hours before my parents did, and my brothers would stay after school, so I would get home first. And if I had a seizure and I was on the bathroom floor, I would just pray that I could crawl back to my room before anyone got home, and then they'd get home and I wouldn't tell them. I would just say I'm sick or something, and I'd be in bed till the next day.
So your parents didn't know about your seizures?
They knew I had seizures when I was 15. They had witnessed one or two. Took me to a doctor. Doctor said I was going through puberty. And that's why I was having seizures. As he's chain smoking, as he's telling my parents this. The rest of the seizures I had, they didn't witness. And I stopped telling them because there was nothing anyone was doing.
Were you worried that they were worried?
Nobody helps me. Nobody will. Therefore, shut up, Lisa, and just get on with it. And as you know, we're East Coast girls. We just get stuff done.
Well, we're East Coast girls, but we're also Sicilian, which is nobody would know from our last names. You know, Wimberger, I'm a real deal.
Yes.
You would never know that we're a couple of Sicilian girls from the East Coast.
True, but that's doubling down on just get it done and muscle through, right?
Yeah.
So my mindset was, if nobody can help me, then I'm just going to just eat it. And I literally convinced myself that everybody had seizures.
You weren't alone.
I truly believed This was entirely normal. Now, when I tell you how that to me, when I say that, that's so ridiculous, because I would wake up with two black eyes, with my head stuck between the toilet and the wall, my feet stuck under the clawfoot bathtub. I would wake up having defecated and urinated all over myself. I couldn't move. I would vomit. I'd have to lay in bed for 2 days. And I literally was so dissociated that I was like, oh, everybody does this. The doctor said this is puberty. The doctor said this is hormonal. That's what hormonal women do. We have seizures. Like, this twisted story was here.
Well, because you're in survival mode. And you also don't have a vagus nerve to activate to go from parasympathetic to sympathetic. Now, I know that you know a lot more about this than you did back then.
Yes.
And there's a lot more to your story, which we'll get to. But can you just explain, like, the function of the vagus nerve and then also, like, the difference between parasympathetic and sympathetic real quick?
Yes. Vagus nerve, command central, first line of interpretation of the world between brain and body. So when you're born, you have to make sense of the world from inputs. And all those inputs through your senses have to command your body to do things. Right. That's the vagus nerve's job. It is taking thoughts from the brain and signaling the body to respond. And it's taking signals from the body, signaling the brain to make sense and meaning of it. So it's a bidirectional highway, goes from the brainstem through the whole length of the spinal column, and it governs every organ in the body. So when your vagus nerve has been electrocuted, you don't have regulation governance over your heart, your lungs, your gut, your thoughts. You're really easily pushed outside any threshold of resilience because you've been fried. So that's the vagus nerve. And what it does is it either brings you into this space of homeostasis that says everything around me is pretty cool right now. I guess I will be able to rest and digest my food. And that's homeostasis.
Right.
Which is called ventral vagal parasympathetic. And when you hear people out there going, you need to be parasympathetic, they mean you need to be ventral vagal parasympathetic. It's a very specific kind, and it is rest and digest. But there's a very dangerous kind of parasympathetic that people who don't know how to differentiate just sort of lump it all into one thing. Dorsal vagal parasympathetic is complete and utter shutdown. The sympathetic has two personalities. We really only want to strive for the personality that gives us rest and digest access. The dorsal personality of the vagus nerve is going to shut off your heart. It's going to freeze you in an attempt to save your life in some critical moment where you have to go frozen and quiet, like if you were an animal chased by a predator. Sympathetic, we all kind of are more familiar with, which is an arousal state of stress, agitation, anger, rage. The vagus nerve is making meaning of everything in every moment and going, do I escalate this up to sympathetic? Do I give you an opportunity to rest and digest, or do I shut you down? And that's what's happening.
It's also the fight or flight, right? So it's like, if you are being chased by an animal, do you have to be quiet and shut down? Or do you have to run like your bund is on fire and get the heck out of there, right?
Totally. And if you have a conditioned vagus nerve, it will be able to escalate to run if need be with no problem. It will do that just fine. But if you have vagus nerve that's deconditioned through trauma, stress, blunt force, electrocution,
right,
lack of nurture, then it's not going to escalate you to a congruent response to the world. It's going to go to shut down as like a quick fix for everything, which is what my nervous system was doing.
And so you've already developed until 15 years old, right? So, which is a good and a bad thing, because you're still in your brain's development stage, right? I think, what do they say? It's up until age 26 or something like that.
For the prefrontal cortex, yes, unfortunately.
Right. So like nobody should get married or, you know, buy a house or a car, or make any like huge decisions before they're 20.
So literally.
Yeah. But you've like fried your mainframe, which is, you know, you're losing function, right? You just said you woke up in like a bed of stool. You woke up with two black eyes. You didn't know how you got there.
Multiple concussions.
Right. And so now it takes you 15 years to kind of go through this stumbling through phase. And then what happens when you turn 30?
What happens is I have this grand mal tonic-clonic seizure in the doctor's office serendipitously, and he gives me the diagnosis, which he might as well have been speaking another language because I didn't understand what he was saying. I didn't understand vasovagal. Right. I didn't know anything about the body or neuroscience or nervous system, but he gave me words that I needed. And those words opened up a rabbit hole of, I'm going to figure this out. But first, I have to figure out what he just told me. So I went on this rabbit hole of like, what can I study to tell me about me? I never went to study any of the things I studied because I wanted to be an entrepreneur. I was like, not even a thought. I just wanted to not die. Like, it's as simple as that. And I started learning about the nervous system, the vagus nerve, polyvagal theory, neuroscience, neuroplasticity, and these pieces were coming together. Now, mind you, I had also a very robust meditation practice since I was a very small child. I have been meditating currently for 43 years. I was a fanatic. So I had a delivery vehicle. Meditation was not helping my body. Now I have information, neuroscience, keys to help my body. How do I make this pragmatic and how do I apply this? Oh, what if I put it in a meditation delivery capsule and backwards engineer this so that it's delivered in some really very efficient formula that then I can get into my nervous system and start rewiring stuff because science is telling me I can do this, but they're not giving me a practice. Meditation gave me practice, but it's not cutting the mustard. I have to make these things meet in the middle.
What did you do for work before you had this aha moment? What were you doing? Obviously you're working and earning a living, right?
I was being dangerous to small children. I was a school teacher.
Okay.
Okay. When you put a dissociated and dysregulated New York Sicilian in a classroom with 13-year-olds, like, I couldn't imagine a worse thing I could have done with my life. I was a school teacher. Then I went into the corporate world and I became instructional design and project manager in the corporate world for a bunch of years. That's what was paying my bills at that time.
You have kind of like this high powered job, but you're still having issues, but you're also educating yourself on how you can make this neurosculpting sandwich between. But I don't know if anybody's ever said that to you.
No one has. I love it.
Not cutting the mustard of, you know, of taking the science and the practice. Nobody's put the two together until you started putting the two together.
Yes.
But you also had another big moment happen.
So I got my diagnosis at 30. I had my daughter at 34, still having seizures. And they're getting worse because with neuroplasticity, the more you access a stress response, the more efficient it gets in being accessible. So the seizures were getting worse. I was flatlining longer. And now my job goes away. My contract dissolved. My marriage dissolved. And now I'm a single mom. By the time she's 1.5, I'm out of work. And I'm like lingering on a contract for a little bit. Now at just about 3, I'm sitting in a food court with her and just trying to figure out how to get my stuff together. And we're eating lunch and I bit into a chicken bone. I flatlined right in front of my kid. Like, I just crashed into the plate, flipped over backwards, landed on my head. Meanwhile, when you're having seizures, your consciousness is doing something else. Like, I was fully conscious in a different realm. I grabbed her out of the high chair. We walked into the bathroom. I'm looking at my bloody tooth. I'm trying to find the dentist phone number. That's my conscious visceral memory. I remember tasting blood from the tooth that I thought I knocked out. None of that actually happened. What happened was I just instantly seized after biting into a chicken bone and wake up to paramedics. Now, I was out long enough for someone to find me, because there was only one person up in the food court. I was out long enough for the store manager to find out I had seized, call the ambulance. The ambulance show up. So however many minutes that was, I was gone. I'm hearing them tell me to breathe. So clearly I'm not breathing. I open my eyes and the world pixelates and comes back into focus. And I'm thinking, oh my God, I had a seizure. Do I have a daughter?
Wow.
Is she with me?
Wow.
Or did I make that up? Did I make up that I had a kid? Like I couldn't tell what was real and what was not. She comes running over. She witnessed the whole thing.
That's terrifying.
It was terrifying. So that was the second to last seizure I had. It was so bad, and I damaged her and us in the process that I knew, like, I'm at game's end.
Right.
Because
you got to figure out the sample.
I got to figure this out. Because if I'm alone the next time I seize, we're done. And so that's when I really accelerated, what can I do? And then that led to the worst seizure ever, which was right after that one, where I just could not breathe. And I had to keep my boyfriend at the time, he had just come into my life, kept trying to get me to breathe over and over and over again. And that was the last one. I'm like, this is it. We're done. I don't want to come back into this body. I was watching myself. I was like, I'm not going back there. I'm about to defecate all over myself if I go back into that body. And then I remembered, oh, I got a daughter in a crib.
Right.
Whoa. So that was the last seizure I ever had, because that after I came back from that one, I was like, oh, I'm figuring it out. Created the neurosculpting 5-step protocol. Used myself as a guinea pig, did this inside of a meditation for like 7 months, rehearsing a different response to stress. I was literally rehearsing fight or flight instead of freeze.
So even when you were younger, you knew when you went to the doctor, like, I'm about to pass out. Like, something's not right. I'm about to pass out. So you knew that, like, when it was about to happen.
There's a tiny little window. It's a fraction of a second or two. For me, anyway, it's called the seizure halo, or some people have auras. When you have epilepsy, you have auras. But for me, I had a little, like, my stomach would go like, goop, like I just went over a bump. And I would start, I'd instantly have a cold sweat. And maybe I have enough time to utter a word, one word. Usually I would hear myself say no, and that was it. Or, you know, like some kind of exclamation.
So I'm thinking not a lot about like other things besides just, and I want to get to your 5 steps and what you've come up with, because it's absolutely freaking brilliant. And I don't even think like the best scientists, doctors, innovators in the world could ever figure this out, because they didn't go through what you went through. But neurosculpting is not just for people with seizures. There's so many applications. So can you like list out all of the different people and benefits that neurosculpting could have?
Yeah. So I have clients all over the spectrum. So any pattern in the nervous system can be rewritten. So I have clients that come in with self-sabotage patterns, right? Mental patterns, emotional patterns of reactivity. That's one realm where neurosculpting can help. Another realm is the mental fixation thoughts, anxiety or depression. Neurosculpting has been really applicable with my clients that come in with those themes. But then there's this whole segment of mind-body connection where people are coming to me either with chronic pain or comorbidities of Lyme and mold or Parkinson's or ALS or a spinal cord injury or traumatic brain injury, stroke, and the capacity for neurosculpting to mitigate symptoms is mind-blowing. And, you know, I'm not a doctor and I would never tell someone this is going to cure you, but holy moly, I've been doing this almost 20 years now. And I have case studies that are mind-blowing. We have gotten C4 partial sever spinal cord injury to move her fingers again after 11 years of paralysis. I've gotten a T6 to move his toe by tricking his visual system. I've got a Parkinson's client where we mitigated 13 symptoms from pre to post meditation every single week for 3 months. I've got traumatic brain injury clients that accelerated their healing, got off seizure meds. I've had 4 or 5 teenage girls who mitigated their seizures with this process. I had no capacity to help my client with ALS. So what we did with neurosculpting with him was we worked on the emotional resilience and readiness to deal with what he was experiencing in the body, right? You can't rewire everything. But it's fascinating. We've gotten left hemisphere stroke clients to be able to get a whole new word and vocalize it in a 20-minute meditation compared to 8 months of speech therapy where they had a vocabulary of 2 words. Like, wow. The stuff that happens when you know how to tinker efficiently, it's powerful.
So you went through over 20 years of, some would call it hell, right?
Yeah, because I started seizures at 15. My last one was at age 38.
Right. So 23 years of hell. And now, because of everything you've gone through, you get to help all of these people. And I get emotional every time you tell these stories because I've actually seen a lot of your testimonials and the people that you've worked with, and they get so emotional and they're so grateful to you for pouring your pain into this purpose and into this passion for helping other people. Does it feel like you're grateful for the pain?
I mean, I would never change one moment of my life. So in that way, I'm grateful. I would say that I knew the pain was important, but I don't think I felt gratitude for it until I created neurosculpting and found the solution. I knew the pain was for a reason, but I was definitely not finding the bliss and the cosmic expansion of it all. Mm. When I had my daughter and realized that, oh, I love someone this much. And then I started looking at how I loved myself and I couldn't figure out that I did. It was mind-blowing. I was like, oh my God, I don't love myself. So she taught me love. Love lit the fire under my butt to fix this so I could be in her life. She was my miracle. She was the light, is still. And it was that converted the pain into gratitude. So you're asking me now? Yes, I'm very grateful for it. If you asked me right before I figured it out, I would have said, I'm done. I'm done. So time makes a big difference. And it's not even something I think about. When you're bartering and you're flatlined and you decide it was a choice to come back in, there's a very imminent, ever-present reality that this is not a dress rehearsal, nor is there a lot of time.
In the grand scheme of things, too, you know, we think about these guys, biohackers, right, who are trying to live forever. The Brian Johnsons of the world, we talk about often. And it's not really about the amount of time. It's about how you use that time and what you want to be the outcome of the time that you spend here, right? Like, so
yes,
that's what my daughters have taught me. It's not about dying in a pile full of cash in a gold tomb because you can't take it with you, right? You're building a life so that that life and that purpose, because of the pain and the gratitude that you have for that pain, can live on in some sort of impactful way. And I know that neurosculpting will continue to live on. So tell us a little bit more about what specifically that sandwich entails.
15-minute guided meditation is the delivery. And there's 5 steps to it. And your guide, the user is guided through it by a guide or my voice or a recording. And I will move the listener through 5 sequenced steps that are boosting plasticity every step of the way so that the thing you are focusing on is not only spotlighted, but everything else is distractions are diminished and your nervous system is outside of its resistance, so it's listening and responding. So you have to set conditions in the nervous system to get the work done. So step one, we have to quiet the midbrain because otherwise it's in resistance and we're not going to change anything.
Right.
Step one,
resistance is the opposite of plasticity, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, because like some people will think of plastic as like being very rigid, but plasticity actually means more flexible.
It means adaptable, moldable.
Right, okay.
So step one, we give the user some prompts to think about that very naturally help dial down midbrain resistance. Very quickly, it happens in like 1.5, 2 minutes. Step two, we fire up focused, recruited attention, which generally happens when the prefrontal cortex gets all excited. And we do that with simple verbal prompts that get that part of the brain very aroused. So now we've got, you know, what Andrew Huberman says, the gold standard of neuroplasticity, which is the combination of non-sleep deep rest and recruited focused attention.
Mm.
That is an induction for the brain.
Mm.
And when that happens, by the end of step two, your nervous system is paying more attention to whatever it is you want to tell it with less resistance. So basically, you're on stage able to deliver some new instructions to your nervous system, and it's more probable that it will grab those instructions and embody them and make them real. So we're doing probability.
If you think about somebody who has some sort of traumatic injury, they're already diminished in their capacity to control whatever it is, a physical function, a mental function. You have people that have reoccurring thoughts that they just can't get rid of. So this is giving them the stage to say in the first few steps, all right, now I have control. Really?
Yes.
Right? That's what you're doing, right? You're giving them control.
I call it authorship.
Authorship.
Yeah, we're giving them authorship and we're priming the nervous system to be all ears, right? So now in step three, we direct the user to whatever pattern they would like to edit. For me, I was trying to edit my seizure response to stress.
Mm.
For some clients, they might want to edit their habituated negative self-talk. For others, they might want to edit that one memory of that one fight they can never take back, right? It doesn't matter what you want to edit. You have a ripe stage in which to do it. Mm. So we call up that pattern by way of bilateral stimulation in step three. We want both sides of the brain involved. We don't want an accidental reliving of something terrible. We don't want a reinforcement of some story you've told yourself a million times. We want bilateral stimulation to break a pattern.
Mm.
And so we're looking at the old pattern with a very new kind of vibration, so to speak, bilateral stimulation. And then we make creative associations, edits. We make edits, mental edits, because when the nervous system is listening, they don't differentiate between mental edits and environmental edits. Edits are edits. And the nervous system is going, oh, you're going to change that association right now? I might go with that. I might change that horrible intensity of that argument from level 10 to level 7. And then we'll invite them to do some physical things like breathing a little bit more congruently with the thing they're editing. And then step 4, we have them anchor into their edit with a somatic gesture using Hebb's law of linking and syncing. And this is like cognitive behavioral therapy elements. And then in step 5, they give it a linguistic association, linguistic play there. And so by the end of a 15-minute experience, they've induced their brain to buy an edit that they're making in a way that doesn't cause a reliving, and then anchored into it with gestures and words that can now act as signals and on buttons to reinforce that edit throughout the day by making the hand gesture or saying the word. Very much like post-hypnotic triggers kind of thing.
Right. That's really fascinating. So do you have a bunch of people just walking around mumbling to themselves and
yes,
and doing your stuff with their...
So my long-term clients are like, Lisa, how many hand gestures can I make? I'm like, just make one for all the meditations.
All of them.
I mean, you've seen Lord of the Rings, like one ring to rule them all.
Yeah.
Just make one hand gesture.
Just one.
And then it like activates a cascade and a domino effect of all the greatest meditations you've ever done. It's like the code for the playlist. Just do one hand gesture.
It's the play button. Just pressing the play button. Now, what is the most common hand gesture?
Most people end up tapping either their chest or their gut seems to be very common. And a lot of people tap here.
Yeah, but
it's
not.
Whatever the user wants to do. It's not like that. The gesture positioning doesn't mean anything dogmatically or spiritually. It only means something to the user. So you can tap, touch, make a hand gesture, whatever you want to do.
I thought maybe it would be the middle finger. No, I'm just kidding. Screw this thing that I want to re-anchor.
I have had people do that in meditation.
Have you? That's so
yes,
funny.
I have.
That's so funny.
Yeah.
So you have this 15-minute protocol, but you do so much more on top of that. So tell me how you work with an average person or what you're willing to do.
I'm willing to do pretty much anything within legal limits and ethical limits of like, I will work with you and figure out a way to get you the support you need. That's my mentality. But there's education. I want my clients to be autonomous. I want them to graduate from me and never see me again. Mm. And if I deprive them of the education necessary for them to make their own informed decisions, then I keep them on my calendar. With all my clients, they are going to get education around how this works, why it works, and how they can be self-sufficient with it so they do not have to come back to me.
Right.
That's my goal, which also like is not very projectable income, I have to be honest. It's like if I keep telling people you're done, go, I have to get new clients. And it's the opposite of I can project my income, but it's congruent with how that person is going to be so self-sufficient that when they encounter something outside of what they originally came to me for, they will have the education enough to know how to synthesize what I taught them and apply it to some new situation.
That's the efficacious and ethical way to build a robust business, an abundant business, because I did Tony Robbins Business Mastery a couple of years ago. And the main thing, you know, we were there for like 5 days up until 2 o'clock in the morning, almost every single night. It was like drinking from a fire hose. We're going through business financial planning. We're going through all this stuff like marketing and sales and yada, yada, yada. The main takeaway for me was focus on getting raving fan customers and the rest will figure it out. And so you're taking care of the person. You're making sure that they're set up for success and that they're autonomous in being able to do that because now they can take care of themselves. And guess what they're probably going to do? They're not going to keep all of this information to themselves. They're going to go out and scream it from the rooftops, which is why I wanted to have you on this podcast, because I want to do a little screaming about you from the rooftops myself, because you're just that amazing and you're doing so many great things. And now you're hosting, is this your first retreat?
I used to do retreats all the time. This is my first retreat in about 7 years.
Wow.
Yes.
So this is a post-pandemic retreat. And you're really starting to hone your practice and expand upon it and grow it. And so what is this retreat all about?
We're going to get congruent. It's called the Congruence Neurosculpting Retreat. We are going to dive into hours and hours of neurosculpting, nervous system regulation, and you're going to be able to hone in on those patterns in your subconscious that are sabotaging your conscious desires. Wow. And that's where suffering comes from. It comes from that incongruence. So we're going to hone in on those patterns, and you're going to start to move your nervous system into a spot to either edit those patterns so they're congruent with your conscious hopes for your life, or intentionally shift your conscious goals to map to what you're finding in your subconscious so that you're not overtaxing your nervous system for zero reason. And then there's going to be yoga and sound healing, sound bath. And then we have spatial audio, VR, composed surround sound pop-up experience for nervous system regulation. So it's really a chance for me to sit with people as a group live and in person, which I miss so much. I miss the in-person. I teach all the time online and it's wonderful, but I want to have meals together. And that's what we're going to do there. Keeping it small so I can give really good personal attention. We have a few spots and it's going to be amazing. And I hope some of you decide to come.
It's June 20th to 22nd, right? And it's in Colorado?
Yes, it's in Colorado at the beautiful foothills of in Sunrise Ranch, the beautiful foothills of red striated mountains and a lake. And it's just gorgeous.
Oh, gosh, I wish I didn't have three kids graduate. Fifth grade and 2 8th graders all that week. Can you beam me there maybe?
Yes, I'll beam you in.
That would be amazing. So how do people find out more about you? How can they follow you? Yeah. Hopefully you do another retreat, not during graduation season. So that
I'll call you first before I pick the dates.
Thank you.
You can go to neurosculpting.com and find the retreat and classes and all the things we're doing. And then Instagram, obviously, you now know I'm very engaged personally, authentically on Instagram. So if you go to @neurosculpting, I'll be there.
Awesome. And I have one silly question for you that I've been meaning to ask you for a couple of years.
Okay.
Was your hair curly before you got struck by lightning?
No, it was pin straight. No, I'm lying. It was curly.
Your best hair I've ever seen.
Oh, thank you.
Gorgeous, gorgeous hair. As you do a lot of other things besides neurosculpting. I constantly see you lifting weights and keeping yourself in shape. You don't wear a stitch of makeup. You are naturally just absolutely gorgeous. You do not look your age.
Oh, my God. This is like the best compliment I've had all day. I'm getting hot. Thank you so much.
It's all true. We share all truth here on this.
I appreciate it. Well, you're radiating every time I see you. You're radiant. Your journey, your process with your magnificent daughter, I mean, that moved me. That really moved me because it's the mother-daughter thing that I also think we shared that, but
yeah.
No, I watch your stuff too. And I'm like, you're so radiant and you're just stepping out in all these big ways. And I watch all of your stuff.
Oh, thank you. It's terrifying. it honestly is terrifying. You know, I've been behind the scenes so much in my career as a marketer, as a media person. And it is terrifying to step out there and put yourself out there. I'm a part of your neurosculpting Instagram group. And yesterday you posted a video saying like, hey, people, I know I have 100+ thousand followers, but guess what? I don't have a team or a person who's creating content for me, all of this is coming from me. So I'm sorry I'm not posting every single day, and I'm sorry I'm not giving you all of the information, but here's some amazing, efficacious information about this amazing retreat that you're hosting, all of the other things that you're doing. And I just freaking love you for saying that, because I do my own social media too. I do have someone that helps me like create the stuff, but I'm always like, she probably hates me because I'm constantly posting stuff like outside of the content calendar.
Yeah.
But listen, we have to be our authentic selves in every aspect of the word. So I just wanted to give you some massive props and
thank you.
Claps around the circle for being authentic and out there.
You know, I have a marketing consultant that's trying to rein me in, is not working. Like, she's like, you should have someone manage your social media. I'm like, nope. Probably smart for time efficiency. I have to create the content myself, because if it doesn't move me, I can't deliver it with authenticity. It has to move me first, because I'm the transmission. There was a couple moments in the past where I was like, maybe I'll have ChatGPT create. No.
Yeah, I actually just wrote an article for the Global Women magazine about not using ChatGPT for content. I wake up every morning and I read Jesus Calling, and I prayer is my main form of meditation, and gratitude is my main way of, you know, neurosculpting or creating some sort of shift, constant anchoring and shift. I'm anchored in gratitude constantly, because life is precious. To your point, it is short. And if we take it for granted and we sweat the small stuff, then we're going to miss it. We're going to miss all of the golden nuggets of life. And so that's why I wanted to share your story, because you spent 23 years figuring it out. And now I hope you spend another 100 years in practice, helping thousands, if not millions of people get the results out of life that they want.
Yeah, that's my goal. Only 8 billion people on the planet. No problem.
No problem. I mean, listen, you're the content creator master, so you can reach all of those people from the comfort of your home. But I miss giving you a hug, and I wish I could come to your amazing retreat. But hopefully I can see you soon. And thank you so much for sharing your story and your time with us today on the Optimize We podcast. I love you.
I love you. It's my pleasure.
And I'll see you soon.
This edition of the Optimize We podcast is brought to you by the Biohacking Index. Visit biohackingindex.com for ratings and reviews of your favorite wellness solutions and wellness providers.